Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Bob and Yurt Live. I'm the pastor of Denver Bible Church. And on our previous show, we were talking about a book, God, Time, and the Incarnation. And this question of, is God outside of time such that for him, he experiences everything in an eternal now? Because the incarnation where God the Son became flesh raises a question of how could God be outside of time if, in fact, he entered human history and he was not man before, and now the permanence of the incarnation, he's forever man. That's the question. And as I was reading this book in a coffee shop yesterday, a woman came up to me. She had her Bible, and she saw the title of my book, actually Richard Holland's book, laying on the table. And so she came to ask me a question. So let's see. Do we have Richard back? We do. Richard Holland, welcome back to Bob and Yurt Live.
Thanks, Bob.
You are the assistant professor of apologetics and theology with Liberty University Baptist Theological Seminary. You've written such a fun book. It's an honor to have you back on the show. Richard, this woman came up to me and she said, I don't understand why we're supposed to pray. Because if God cannot change, if he cannot change, why pray? And so I was so thrilled that I was reading your book, Richard, and I was able to tell her the story of the incarnation. Mm. And the incarnation challenges the traditional view that God is utterly immutable. I could see where she would get her question from if, like on page 20 of your book, you're describing Plato, and Plato was talking about time, and he looked at the planets, and he suggested that somehow the planets, it's sort of like the planets made time. Like
right.
The planets are a clock, and clocks make time. And,
right.
And it seems like that really has made an impact on Western thinking, even though I don't think it's true at all.
It has, yeah. Yeah, Plato very much, and Aristotle after him, very much linked the idea of physical change in the universe to time. He connected those two things together.
And in fact, Isaac Newton then, when he discussed time, he looked at physical time and true time. He made a mm-hmm. distinction. And could you describe that distinction for us? And then I'd love to talk about how you're sort of redeeming Isaac Newton's reputation, I think.
Yeah, and first, you know, just sort of my disclaimer is I don't pretend to be a physicist. I don't have an advanced degree in science. But in this case, I think it's okay because I think the problem here is not a problem of physics, it's a problem of metaphysics. It's philosophical commitments that really divide Newton and Einstein, not necessarily their views on physics. So, you know, Newton talks about the absolute reference frame, and so often that's criticized in an Einsteinian way of looking at everything of relativity, the theory of relativity. How could there be an absolute reference frame? Well, I don't even think Newton conceived of there being an absolute reference frame in the physical world. I don't think that was his view at all.
Well, and you quote him and you point out that Newton acknowledges the impossibility of developing an absolutely perfect clock.
Right.
And his insights were astounding. Not only general relativity and calculus, he explained to the world what color is. I mean, a pretty sharp guy, utterly committed to the creator God of the Bible. That was his perspective. But mm-hmm. but he said from different perspectives, different frames of references, basically, we'd see clocks operating a bit differently. I mean, that's pretty close to, that's not as different from Einstein as somebody would want to claim.
That's right. That's right. There isn't really much of a difference when they talked about physics.
It seems that way. And so then, but I could see how, because Einstein was essentially an atheist and Isaac Newton wrote more about the Bible and biblical chronology and world history than he did about math or science. I could see how almost a revisionist history of science would like to make Newton as wrong as they could possibly claim that he was.
Yeah, that might be what's happening. I mean, Einstein made it clear, I think, that he's beginning with the assumption that there's nothing outside of the physical universe. And so if that's the assumption you start with, well, sure, then you do have problems with some of the things Newton said. But again, it's Newton's metaphysical commitments, his philosophical commitments, where he differs from Einstein.
So Newton conceives of absolute time, which would flow uniformly, he says, and he seems to relate that to the eternal, to God.
Right.
And then he has relative time, which is when we measure time, regardless if it's planets going around the sun or if it's a quasar today or an atomic clock. And so he calls that relative. By the way, when you talk about Newton's metaphysics, the very terms physics and metaphysics, they go back to Aristotle, right?
Right.
And Aristotle writes his classic work on physics, and then his next book is Metaphysics or After Physics,
right,
where he talks about the nature of being and these kinds of philosophical things. And it doesn't mean that any of this contradicts physics.
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
In fact, originally it was just a library term. It was commentators later on. They refer to the different sets of works, and well, you had the ones that deal with physics, and then you had the ones that deal with that came after the ones on physics, and so it just applied that catalog term, metaphysics, the ones after physics.
Yeah, and there's so much of what Aristotle wrote in his work on physics that physicians today would not even recognize.
Right.
So, could I challenge Newton's conception a little bit? It's rather brash of me to try that, but because we have the utmost respect for him. But when he's talking about absolute time, it seems to me that that is time. And when he's talking about relative time, I think he's talking about clocks. And I find in my informal conversations and in debates with people for decades now, that human beings have a very difficult time distinguishing between time and clocks.
Right.
And I think it goes all the way back to Plato saying that the planets make time.
Right.
And when I read Newton on absolute time and relative time, the only real difference is that the relative time, we can't be exact. We can't be precise. Our measurement of it is always imprecise. It's always off. So I don't know. To me, there's time, and then is our efforts to measure it. And the efforts to measure it, we get wrong. But time itself, if time is a description of God's reality the way truth is, well, then time is time. Anyway, does that all sound totally uneducated to you, Richard?
No, I mean, that's pretty close to the way I see it, I think. I think if you want to summarize Einstein, for example, I think for Einstein and probably for Plato, although it would be anachronistic to say it this way, but that they would say that time is simply what clocks measure. And there's really nothing else to it. Well, if that's your starting point, then of course it would be quite difficult to see how God's existence could in any way be temporal. If all it is
how we
a pendulum
measure
on
time.
A clock or the Earth spinning around the sun, if that's really what time is,
right,
well, then sure, it would be problematic for what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, like if one of the first clocks was, let's say an Eskimo took a seal bladder, filled it with water, and it counted the drips at the bottom, mm-hmm. then if he squeezed it, he found out that he sped up time.
Right.
I mean, to me, so many physicists, that's what they're talking about. And so it's like the clock, if the clock speeds up for some physical force, that doesn't inherently mean that time has sped up.
Right.
But anyway, could we get to McTaggart? I love your discussion of McTaggart. Could you explain, now we're into contemporary philosophy, but can you explain to the audience who he is and what was his contribution to his conclusions? I think are wild. Most theologians think they're wild, but he contributed something to the debate.
Right. So McTaggart, his famous work is The Nature of Existence. And really why he remains significant, I think, is not really for his conclusions. His ideas were kind of wild. But why he remains significant is because he's given us some of the terminology that is still in use to this day about the nature of time. And so he talks about the nature of time, and the distinction between two different theories about what time is sometimes described in the way he described it. He gave these names, A series and B series, to think about the nature of time, and I'll try to summarize that if I can. It's a little bit complex, but essentially the question is time dynamic or is it static? And so he talks about the relationship between moments in time, and there's one way you could think of it is before and after, that some things happen before other things and some things happen after other things. And so we would say that that's the dynamic or the A series of time.
Mm-hmm.
But the other way to look at that would be to say that things don't really happen before or after. Instead, you conceive of time like being a stretched out line. And instead of saying before and after, you would say earlier than or later than. And the intent behind shifting that language to earlier than or later than is to take the tense out of it.
Hmm.
Because
well,
that,
Richard, if we looked at a number line and we said that the number -3 is earlier than the number 7,
right,
then we don't mean it's before the number 7. It's just it precedes it in some logical way, but
exactly.
Not necessarily before.
Exactly. And that number line illustration then is a good illustration to convey the two different ways that philosophers now look at what time is. On the one hand, philosophers will say that time is very much like that number line, so that -3 is not before 7, it's just earlier than. So, you know, for example, July 5th, 1955, they would say that that's not really before today. They would just say that it's earlier than today on that temporal line. And that's to be distinguished with the dynamic view of time that says, no, it really is before and after temporal distinctions, that day, July 5th, 1955, was really in the past, and it's before today.
So now this McTaggart, what he concluded after, you know, these are ways of looking at the issue that he popularized. But then his conclusion was wild, that there's no such thing as time.
Right.
Time is not real.
Right.
But he made a statement about the A series of past, present, and future. And he said, when you look at things that we indicate as something's past, something's present, and something's future, he says that we say, well, that's because they're in time, and that's why they're that way. And he says, oh, you've just made a circular argument. And because you've made a circular argument, that's a contradiction. And so, therefore, you're not justified in believing in time. I know this is a bit of a heady topic for a radio audience. But just one observation I have about that. There are all kinds of presuppositions that we make the presupposition of God's existence, the presupposition of the validity of the laws of logic, the presupposition of our own, the validity of our own identity and our continued identity. And so if we make a presupposition, let's say, about time, that is not the same thing as a contradiction. That's not saying I've just contradicted myself. If I make a presupposition, if I'm honest, I may have to acknowledge, hey, I made a presupposition. But when Taggart says that's a contradiction, I think he goes too far in his criticism.
Right. I think that it's clear that we do, everybody makes presuppositions. Everybody begins with a starting point of some kind in these debates. So I think you're probably right. I criticized him a little bit in my book about that.
Mm-hmm. So then you come to a character that I enjoyed reading about, Oscar Cullman, in his Christ and Time. And he did something that we've done in a very superficial way in an article I've written about God and Time on our website. But he went through and he looked at biblical terminology. For him, it was especially New Testament terminology. And he looked at it in the Greek. As a radio talk show host, I felt comfortable enough just looking at it in the English for our audience. Cullman comes to a conclusion that when you look at what the New Testament words about time, that they never indicate timelessness or an atemporal existence in heaven or for God, but that everything has to do with a duration, a never-ending, an everlasting, a forever and ever kind of existence.
Right.
I think it's hard to challenge him as far as his argument goes. Just on that, it's hard to disagree because the New Testament doesn't use the Plato and Aristotle terminology that God is in an ever-present now. There's no before. There's no after. He's timeless. He's atemporal. The New Testament, indeed, the Bible from beginning to end doesn't use that kind of terminology as far as I've seen and as far as Cullman has pointed out.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he says this, and I think he's probably right. After he examines the New Testament specifically for words, for time and eternity, he makes the argument that he says that primitive Christianity knows nothing of a timeless God.
Mm.
So now, just as a point of caution, that doesn't mean necessarily that it makes it an open and shut case. Well, because the early church and because the New Testament doesn't speak of a timeless God.
Right.
Therefore, God is not timeless. It doesn't necessarily mean, but it is,
right.
On the other hand, though, some pretty powerful evidence against the traditional view when you consider that the Bible doesn't speak in any way similar to what the traditional view says has to be true about God.
And when Cullman, he goes too far, and probably this is one reason why philosophers and theologians have reacted negatively against him, he suggests that there is no role whatsoever for philosophy because all you have to do is look at a lexicon, like look at
right.
a dictionary, and you'll know everything you need to know about time. And so he overstated his case
right.
terribly, but then we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, as others have done, and suggest that, well, a survey of the biblical vocabulary is not relevant.
Right.
Well, it very well may be relevant.
It is.
And
I think one of the strong points in Cullman's work, and I think this is one of the reasons why I focused on him in the book, is because it's an example of using theology to figure out these philosophical puzzles. And that's my overarching point, is that we need to begin with these important theological commitments, namely the incarnation. And then once we say what the incarnation means, and we embrace it, then we use that to govern what we say about God's relation to time.
Hmm. You have four observations you make after you talk about Cullman, and I'd like to hit on each of them. They're just so great. You say, first, we should admit that the Bible exclusively uses the language of temporality, and nowhere does it include of Plato's concepts of timelessness.
Right.
So that's a first, and we've pointed that out in the article we've had online about time. Second, you say that the Bible also uses history as an objective parameter marking God's life and activity.
Yes.
And history is temporal. For example, right. God created, God prophesied of the coming of the Messiah, and then God the Son came into human history in the incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, we looked forward to the cross, we mankind at some level, that God would save us. And since then, we look back, and it even seems that God looks back to the cross, and God looked forward to the cross. So
right, yeah, and I think one of the ways this is highlighted is you think about the Old Testament, how many times God commands his people to remember. And even now in our churches, we talk about redemption and God's plan for redemption. And we do exactly what you're describing. We look back to the past and what God did in the past. And we take on the perspective of those in the Old Testament who were looking forward to the coming of the Messiah in the future.
So someone defending the traditional view of God being timeless, atemporal, would say, well, that's us. That's not God. But Jesus and the Bible refers to things that God did, like when Christ was not in the state of incarnation, like the Father shared glory with the Son before the world was. You quote that out of the Gospel of John. And they planned for the body of Christ. And so God created, and he created in a sequence. He didn't make man before he made the heavens and the earth,
right,
nor simultaneous with them, like before the plants. So God did these things. He prophesied he would send his Son. He sent his Son. His Son came. Now God looks back, and Jesus is in heaven waiting until his enemies are made his footstool.
Right.
That God the Son is waiting for that, and it will happen.
Right.
So, wow, that's all. So the Bible presents God in a historical, temporal way. Then your third point, which is just fabulous, is that the Bible indicates that sin is the cause of decay, not time.
Right.
What a...
I think it's so important. It seems to me, especially when you reflect on the earlier, like Plato and some of the conversation we had previously about that, somehow or another, we got the idea that time is what brings decay.
Well, I
just don't see that when I read the Bible.
Well,
I think that the Bible uniformly makes the case that sin is what causes decay.
Well, and Richard Holland, again, we're speaking with the author of God, Time, and the Incarnation. Richard is assistant professor of apologetics and theology with Liberty University Baptist Theological Seminary. Richard, in your book, you tell us exactly where we got it from. We got it from Aristotle in his Physics, where, here, I'll quote you, quoting him. Aristotle writes, this is centuries before Christ, time is by its nature the cause of decay.
Mm-hmm.
It is the number of changes, and change removes what is. Hence, plainly, things which are always are not in time. Well, that is a bold assertion that any change would bring about a degradation of perfection.
Yes.
And therefore, time involves change, so therefore God cannot be in time. And it all goes right back to that. So for you to state that the Bible indicates that sin is the cause of decay and not time, and I think that's obvious from even just the creation week. As you point out in your book, there was no decay on day one of creation, day two, day three. There was no sin, no corruption. That happened after Adam and Eve or the fall.
Right.
All right. And then fourth, you say that nowhere does the Bible indicate that time is a thing created.
Right. Yeah, the Bible doesn't say anywhere that God created time. It says instead that God created the sun, the moon, and the stars.
Wow.
And I just don't see in Scripture anywhere any inkling that time is bound up with the physical creation. Mm.
God, right, Genesis chapter 1, God made, you said the sun, the moon, and the stars. God made matter, you know, the earth and all. He made the heavens, space. He made light. He made life, biological life. He made man and the angels. So God made matter, space, light, and life. But it, like you said, it doesn't say God made time. But Richard, if you, I have read at least 50 times in different articles and books that Genesis 1 says that God created time. And then they say in the first three words, in the beginning, that tells us that God created time. And I think, wow.
That's a stretch.
That's a stretch because Jesus is quoting from Genesis 1. And he says, in the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female. Mm-hmm. So Jesus is providing that. If it's in the beginning of the feast, it means on the first day of the feast.
Right.
In the beginning of the year, it means in the first day of the month, first month. In the beginning of the creation, that means when God started the creation, here's how he started.
Exactly.
So you are right. The Bible does not say in my study that God is that God created time. Those are four powerful observations. Richard, again, we're running out of time. The best way to get your book, God, Time, isn't it funny we're running out of time? God, Time, and the Incarnation, what is the best way to get it?
It's available everywhere. If I were to buy it now, I'd go to Amazon.com, and I would just type in the search window, God, Time, and the Incarnation, and it'll pop up in the search results. There you can buy it at Barnes & Noble and other retailers also.
Right after we ended our previous show with you, I talked to our staff, and we've decided in 23 years, I think in our store, we've carried, I think, five books. Right now we have one book, third-party books, that we promote, Dr. Walt Brown's In the Beginning. But we've decided we'd like to stock your book, God, Time, and the Incarnation. So I know generally Amazon is the cheapest place to get books, even if you are a small retailer like us. So we'll be getting a supply of your book. And thank you. Could you continue on another program, Richard?
That'd be great. It'd be fun.
Oh, I'm just thrilled. Thank you so much for your time. What an honor it is. And wow, to talk with the author of God, Time, and the Incarnation. I feel like because we're doing it this way, we're not rushed. It's not like we only have to hit the highlights. We could talk about some of the fundamental issues, the substance of the debate. And in fact, in our next show, I'd love to ask Richard Holland about where this debate has been. Who have been the main players and how have they arrived at their conclusions about is God outside of time? And I think we're going to find out, the more we go, that the Incarnation affirmatively tells us that God is not outside of time. God bless you guys.